let's start talking crypto. Chris, I think you wrote this headline: the biggest story of Bitcoin in 2022 was the lack of a story. What do you mean by that? And what does that mean about Bitcoin going forward? Is it too boring?
Hello, and welcome to The Crypto Brief, a podcast from the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology. Every week, we get together to discuss current events and trends in blockchain technology, tokenization, DeFi, NFTs, mining, and related aspects of the crypto ecosystem. I'm your co-host, Ryan Stubbe, Director of Bitcoin Mining, and I'm joined by Jason Ward, Head of the Blockchain Incubator, Parth Gargava, Product Architect within Fidelity Labs, and Jack Newrider, Research Analyst with Fidelity Digital Assets. Before we begin, just a friendly reminder that this discussion is for educational purposes only and should not be viewed as investment advice or a recommendation for any security or asset. The views expressed are those of the co-hosts and not necessarily those of Fidelity Investments or its affiliates. As we all know, digital assets are speculative and highly volatile and are only for those investors with a high risk tolerance. So let's dive into what's been happening recently.
It's great to be here. This is a pre-recorded episode from January 11th. Jack and I are here, and we're welcoming a guest, Chris Kiper, who's joining us from Fidelity Digital Assets. So Chris and Jack have been working on a year-in-review retrospective on the crypto markets, and it's going to be coming out soon. So welcome, Chris. Jack, good to see you guys. But before we dive in, how are you guys doing?
Doing well. Thanks, Jason. Thanks for having me back here. It's good to be back on the podcast. And as you mentioned, we have that piece coming out. It'll either be out by the time this is released or soon after. And it's kind of become an annual ritual for us at Fidelity Digital Assets, where we, early on in the year, not only take stock of what's happened in the digital asset space, but more importantly, we take those events and we contextualize them looking forward. And that's really the value add here. We're going to be talking today about what we see in the year ahead, not predictions, point predictions, but just kind of scenarios or base cases or probabilities of what we think we could be seeing, where we think the market's going or the industry is going, and a lot of these different technologies and trends that we're closely following in the year ahead and that we have on our research agenda. So happy to be here. And with that, Jack, let's get right into it. First of all, let's talk a little bit macro. So inflation was the big story. Still is going to be. We're recording this right before tomorrow's print, so that will be out by the time this comes out. It's sure to be an interesting one. I'm sure of that. But longer term, looking out the whole year, what's kind of your base case for this? How does it look with digital assets? And more importantly, do you have any kind of out of consensus opinions or calls here you want to make?
Yeah, I mean, I think you make the clear observation there is last year was a story of inflation, a Fed pivot at the very beginning or end of 2021 into 2022. And now we've sort of entered potentially a different macro environment, or at least over the short term have entered a different macro environment. And part of the story last year was a rise in cost of capital, right? We saw nominal yields rise, and that's a headwind for all assets. I think this year, what we're potentially seeing is signs that inflation has potentially peaked on a backwards looking basis. And that means that maybe the yield headwind has subsided for the time being. And so maybe we've seen some of the worst of rising yields impact on sort of this flight of capital towards safety, rationally so. And then I think as we get deeper into the year, the conversation will shift from a story of interest rates repricing traditional assets and that sort of flowing down into crypto into a discussion around corporate earnings. And I actually think that that ends up mattering to crypto assets, even though, like, what does S&P earnings have to do with the Bitcoin network itself? Like, candidly, nothing at all, really. The network doesn't care or know what the S&P 500's earnings are relative to Wall Street analyst expectations. But ultimately, it does impact risk sentiment, and it does impact the price of equities. And I think that it's a story that matters in the back half of this year, because ultimately, rising interest rates, they don't just instantly impact the underlying fundamentals of an economy. It takes time for those interest rates to sort of seep into reality, so to speak. And so I think that, like, the earnings that we're about to see in the coming weeks, I think in the next 3 weeks or so, we have a major earnings season, but that's for, you know, the last quarter of last year. And so I don't think it matters for a couple of quarters, but I think that we're in this sort of interim period where the interest rate increases haven't leaked into corporate fundamentals, and that ends up actually mattering to crypto in a roundabout way because that changes risk sentiment in the market.
And Jack, if I can just jump in on that for a minute. So I think there's a question as to whether or not we'll see some type of earnings recession or some repricing of the broader indices, such as the S&P 500. And I hear that a lot on different shows that I listen to, but I was also just thinking about your comments around yield. So I did a quick scan back to say, okay, I'm formally supporting fixed income markets. So I always look at 10-year yield. I'm looking at the 2s-10 spread. We've had an inverted yield curve for a while now. And just looking back about a year ago, the 2-year was at about 90 basis points. It's roughly around 4.25% right now, so 425 basis points. And the 10-year was around 1.75, roughly about 3.58. So in spite of the fact that we've got this inversion, that's a pretty significant move. So a lot of people have thought, hey, the Fed is raising interest rates. There's some debate on what the terminal rate will be. I guess I would ask sort of a general question. With whether or not the terminal rate is between 5 and 6%, does it really matter for digital assets? Or is it really more just the broad risk on, risk off macro dynamics that have spilled over? Or does the actual terminal rate possibly play a factor in the direction or the size of the moves we may see in digital assets?
It's a hard question. I think more so it's what's the impact of the sort of rate of change of rates, because we went off of a bottom of effectively zero to this like this hawkish environment of rates, you know, sort of all throughout last year rising relentlessly. And so what does that do to overall market sentiment and the repricing of assets? Well, it causes everybody's models to bake in this changing rising rate over time, and that discounts everything and lowers the present value of those assets if we're saying everyone's looking at this perfectly from a mathematical model, which of course they're not. But that then impacts sentiment, which of course is a very important element to crypto. But I think that if we're at the end or towards the tail end of a rate hiking cycle, that is sort of a net positive because we've readjusted to a higher new normal for the time being, whether or not we stay at these elevated interest rates relative to recent history.
Yeah, I think those are great points to both of you. And to your question, Jason, too, I think Jack has talked about this before. Bitcoin's doesn't have anything to do with corporate earnings, but investors don't invest in a vacuum. Everything's relative, right? So if you do have a higher rate and a higher real rate, that does make digital assets, especially those that don't bear any yield like Bitcoin, less attractive on the margin, right? And that's where these prices are set, on the margin. So I do see that as being a headwind. I'll go out on a bit of a limb here, and one kind of, not black swan, but smaller probability thing that I have in the back of my head, and what made me think of it, Jack, was your note on how we've seen inflation peak and then how you're looking at these lagged effects to the back half of the year. I just can't help think, but inflation may have peaked, but if or when we go into the next recession, because the Fed has moved rates up faster than they ever have before in the last 30, 40 years, I think they're going to have to cut them just as fast, right? And then do you get this kind of second tidal wave of inflation coming back in there because everyone kind of lets down their guard and says, oh, phew, inflation's over, we can cut rates again. And they get really aggressive with the stimulus and the liquidity injections once again. And then, it's a long time, maybe another 6, 12, 18 months later, we see another wave of inflation. I keep going back to the 70s. Everyone kind of thinks the 70s was just one big period of inflation. But there's actually two very distinct waves that happened. A pretty big one where it went up to 10 or so. I'm trying to remember this off the top of my head. Came back down, didn't come back down very far. It still only went down to like 5% or so. And then another huge wave of inflation, right? And so just because we think something's peaked doesn't mean it can't come back roaring back again. And so that's something I've kind of been having in the back of my head for the next year as well.
Yeah, I tend to agree. Not that we have to agree to everything on this podcast, but I do tend to agree. Like, it seems like the broader financial space has sort of come to a conclusion that we're in a completely different environment into the future, where we left this sort of quote unquote easy money period of time. But I don't know if that's the case, because you didn't change the overall debt burdens particularly on government balance sheets? And what's the average duration of government debt? It's like 5.5 years the last time I checked when we were doing a report. And so it takes 5.5 years for like half of your debt to roll over at new interest rates and for then like net interest expense on the public's balance sheet to actually start to impact the kind of the income statement of the actual treasury. So we haven't actually seen that yet.
As I think about this, in the description, yes, we may see waves. And I hear a lot and read a lot about people predicting that we're going to see a reverse trend. But I also see policymakers going out of their way to be explicit about their intent to hold rates higher for longer to try and help.
But is that just jawboning, Jason?
I mean, I don't know. Time will tell. But what I look at as well is, there is an overlap, as we know, between a lot of folks who are interested in Bitcoin and people who are interested in precious metals and gold. And, you know, there's a back and forth. There's lots of memes. I won't dive into that too much. But what I find interesting is this current period, we saw earlier on Monday of this week, gold hit an 8-month high and it was trading back around 1880 an ounce. And you see stories about governments around the world loading up on physical metals at this point. So, you know, as we think about the interest rates, yes, there's more value to holding a long-term debt or government debt, but both are flights to quality. And one thing that you don't have to worry about is gold going to actually bump against some policy debate of whether or not it can hit a debt ceiling and what happens there. So there's these other types of unpredictable events that may factor in. I just find it really interesting that gold is finally acting in ways that we have anticipated gold to act before in terms of a hedge against downward pressure on other markets.
Yeah. And on that note, you mentioned Bitcoin. Let's start talking crypto. Chris, I think you wrote this headline: the biggest story of Bitcoin in 2022 was the lack of a story. What do you mean by that? And what does that mean about Bitcoin going forward? Is it too boring?
Yeah. So listeners of this podcast probably don't find that title or that subheading that exciting. But I think to the average person, this is exciting. And I'm preaching to the choir here, but I think it bears repeating that in this year where we saw just insane things in terms of price action and blowups and potential frauds and all, you name it, anything, you know, under the sun, all these things were on nobody's bingo cards, you would have expected something to be wrong with Bitcoin if you saw the price go down 75%. Like a traditional investor would say, there's a thesis that's broken here. The network has experienced a bug. Something's happened, right? But nope, it just keeps churning blocks out about every 10 minutes. Bitcoin settled 93 million transactions in the year. It transferred 560 million Bitcoin tokens. So the number of transactions was down a little, but the total number of Bitcoin transacted increased by over 100%. It doubled. Now you might say, well, people had to send more Bitcoin because it was worth less in dollar terms, right? But that actually wasn't true either. The dollar equivalent transfers was actually up too. And the Bitcoin network moved $12 trillion, but because of the whole UTXO structure, some of those are change, right? When you send someone money, you get a transaction back that's change. So our friends at Coinmetrics do an adjusted metric where they try to filter that out. And looking at that, Bitcoin still settled a little over $4 trillion in actual USD equivalent transfers in 2022. To put that in perspective, I used to be an equity analyst covering the payment companies. That's about half of what MasterCard did in the last 12 months. And you might say, well, that's apples to oranges, but not really. I mean, these are real dollar amounts that are being transacted all over the globe. And unlike MasterCard, these are final settlement, right? These happen in about 10 minutes average, and it's a final settlement, unlike some of these credit card networks. So again, maybe the time will come when this story gets old and I don't have to keep saying it, but for now I'm going to repeat it and say, despite all this volatility and craziness, the most wonderful thing was Bitcoin acting as designed and just beautifully ticking away.
Yeah. So that's what happened last year. Now looking forward, do you think that there's exciting things happening? I mean, I know we saw Lightning Network channels more than doubled. I think we saw a 60% increase in Bitcoin locked in Lightning channels. Within the Bitcoin community, you can see a little bit of, it's not jealousy for what's being built on Ethereum, but there is a camp in Bitcoin that thinks that, you know, the intentions of Bitcoin is to be this definancialized asset that's intentionally making trade-offs to be simple, secure, and decentralized. There's also a camp that looks at all of these cool things being built on Ethereum and says, could we build it on top of a very solid base layer using something like the Lightning Network? I'm thinking of things like we heard about Taro, potentially having like stable coins or stable value assets on Bitcoin. Do you think some of that stuff going into 2023 will be a bigger conversation or more tangible?
I think so. It's something I'm going to be watching. It's something I don't know a huge amount about now, but I'm going to try to learn a lot more about this. I think Lightning established itself in 2022. It's going to get better with time. And then we've got this kind of edge stuff that you talked about. Like, you know, we had Taproot. I think we'll see more adoption and stuff happen there with privacy. And then we've got things like really on the edge, like Taro or Taro, however you say it, where they're talking about putting stable coins on the Bitcoin network, right? And there's other things too. I was coming across the other day, these mini script ideas or someone putting forth ideas of how to program in different vaults with conditions and stuff like that. And so we often talk about the Bitcoin protocol being ossified, but I think it's important to point out there's still a lot of innovation happening around the edges or with specific things. And that's a great thing. I think it speaks to kind of this ethos of if you consider Bitcoin an ultimate monetary good, wouldn't you want to build capabilities on top of that and not some potentially inferior in some ways substitute, right? Just for more functionality. It's like, what can we do to enhance Bitcoin? And that's got me excited as well. And I think these bear markets are when some of the greatest stuff gets built, right? People hunker down and they just build, put their nose to the grindstone and we'll see what comes out after this year.
And Chris, when you talk about some of those additional capabilities, I know from a research perspective, it's very interesting. We've dug into some of these things, looking at miniscripts. We're looking at, can you write code that helps improve the security or the ease of use for these assets? Particularly, Ethereum's got all these different types of things that people have worked on. But when we think about Bitcoin and the ability to do things like hash or time locks that are executed based on conditions, it gets very interesting because there's all types of applications. Could be estate planning. It could be around contract negotiations. If certain conditions are met, then you can affect a transfer. Or you're looking at how Lightning channels are funded. If people aren't really familiar with Lightning, Lightning is a network that sits on top of Bitcoin, but there are participants who are putting liquidity into that network, and they are facilitating the bilateral movement of coin across this network. And if there are ways to do that in a more capital efficient manner or a better risk managed way, then we may see increased value pushed into the Lightning network.
Yeah, absolutely. And just all the things that have happened over this past year, I think really have turned people's attention to these solutions, right? So these different capabilities to help people hold their own keys or safeguard them in more or better ways or better user interfaces, all that kind of stuff, I think is really exciting. So in some ways, you know, not a lot to say about Bitcoin, but also just something that's really exciting. So with that, we'll go to Ethereum. Jack, you wrote a lot of this section in our upcoming paper. We had the merge, obviously, a huge deal, but everyone says, okay, what have you done for me lately? What's next? Everyone in the Ethereum ecosystem is always chomping at the bit for the next thing on the roadmap. What's 2023 looking like it's going to shape up to be here?
Yeah, like you said, 2022, if we had to use, you know, sort of one catchline phrase, I think pretty much everyone would agree that it's the merge or this transition to proof of stake for Ethereum. I think as we look at 2023, there's sort of two pieces. One, I would almost break it into like the first half and the second half of the year. The first half of the year, and I think it's been more clearly identified in the recent core developers calls, is the Shanghai Capella upgrades, the unlocks of staked Ethereum. This is obviously a benefit to people that have staked the asset or for people that are looking to stake Ethereum. Currently, staked ETH, you can't actually withdraw it from your validator and then go use it on the execution layer. It's stuck on the consensus layer, so to speak. according to recent calls, it looks like the next set of upgrades is going to be like sort of narrowly focused on this, the actual withdrawals. And the current timeline that's floating around is like March of 2023, but we all sort of know that those dates can shift. And so I would say more broadly, if we look at like the first half of the year, if we get staked ETH unlocks, I look at that as a win for sort of Ethereum. And then I think the second half of the year is more of a conversation of scaling, of layer twos continuing to develop, and of some upgrades that developers even wanted to include in Shanghai, such as proto-dank sharding, which is sort of a first major step on the path of scaling Ethereum on its base layer.
And Jack, when you talk about the scaling, things like proto-dank sharding, you're talking about the ability to bundle activity and have that the net effect of that activity recorded on chain. So how would that differ in theory from something like rollups, in optimistic rollups, for example?
Yeah, so proto-dank sharding, it doesn't actually shard anything technically. So this isn't actually the beacon chain being sharded, but it does lay an important foundation for data sharding by creating a new transaction type called a blob, which is designed to post data to Ethereum in a more efficient way. And I think one of the big sort of benefits is for layer twos in particular, because they can use these data blobs that the goal is that blobs won't be competing with normal Ethereum layer one transactions. They'll have two different sets of fees being charged. And then it's sort of like a major stepping stone in Ethereum's path towards scaling and sharding. And so I think you have sort of two things happening in order to, for the future of Ethereum to scale itself. One is the development of these layer twos that we're seeing, you know, catch on. And then the other is Ethereum itself on its base layer, allowing those layer twos to settle more efficiently, as well as scaling itself on its base layer.
So I love it, because I love the taxonomy. We're talking about sharding and blobs. So the way to think about the blob is it's an aggregation of some activity and looking at it, a net effect. But for those who don't know what a shard is, I describe it using an analogy to a highway. It's like right now, Ethereum, the beacon chain, it's a single lane road. And what we're going to do is make it a multi-lane highway by having multiple concurrent chains that are processing. So the computational work is split across additional lanes of travel, but the aggregate is still maintained so that there is a true consensus of the complete network.
And Jason, maybe for someone who's not as in the weeds of Ethereum as myself, how would you rank something like sharding and all of these future things versus the merge in complexity? Is this going to be as big of a deal, like a 7-year lift, or is it relatively easier now that they've laid the groundwork with the merge?
I think it's all been part of the same plan. So I don't think you really get to sharding without the merge, because when you think about the complexity of synchronizing all these different instances of a technology, you have to have something to anchor back to. So what is the touchstone? So I think the merge absolutely is the key enabler to get to sharding, but there are other types of distributed ledger technologies out there that run these multiple rails today. I'm referring to decentralized acyclical graphs. They sometimes look at having multiple different instances. It's complex. I'm not an expert on it, but I do think that by essentially making sure that we have the beacon chain, we have the ability to bring things back together, what you're really talking about is throughput. So I think it's going to take some time to get there with the sharded architecture, but proving that you can do so is really going to increase the throughput speed and the availability of block space. And when Jack talked about the L2s and talked about blobs, what I think about is transaction congestion on the network, driving congestion driving transaction fees. So block space, I think, will become more available over time because you have these scaling mechanisms. Yeah, Jack, I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, and I think it gets to also a theme of 2023 that we're going to hear more of a drumbeat for, which is L2s. like being a part of not only like a critical for the short term future, like the immediate future of Ethereum, but also part of the longer term vision, which is something that Vitalik continues to mention, is even with sharding, there's only so much that you can do to increase throughput on Ethereum's base layer. Whereas we're seeing already like optimistic rollups. If we look at the two of the largest, Optimism and Arbitrum, like we have data in this report that the daily transaction volumes on a number of days recently have rivaled that of base layer Ethereum, right? And these are just two of the optimistic rollup types. That's sort of your preliminary L2 use case or technology. ZK-EVMs are another talking point of the holy grail of L2s that have less trust assumptions than optimistic rollups have. And so I think like all of the conversation around L2s is going to continue to sort of ratchet up alongside Ethereum's own development of its base layer. And we're starting to see like L2 native applications in 2022. We saw GMX, which was on Avalanche, but also on Arbitrum, an L2 of Ethereum. And then we also saw like built out integrations for L2s from Uniswap, Curve, Aave. So a lot of these native layer one Ethereum applications that are starting to be able to build sort of interoperability for the scaling solutions themselves. And that probably continues into the new year.
And Jack, I just want to break down for a moment what a ZK EVM is. So we think about zero knowledge Ethereum virtual machine capabilities. Simply put, I can utilize this technology to obfuscate or maintain privacy about the transactions that I'm processing, but we can prove that they are in fact valid transactions. And I think that is a very important step towards increasing not just privacy, but the ability for participants of the network. So say you might be managing assets, you might be a trader, you want to actually execute your interested trades or trading strategies without them being completely transparent to everyone else. So if you can do that using this type of zero knowledge proof or these L2s or these blobs that allow you to affect the transactions, you can have higher confidence. If you have the ability to integrate these privacy technologies or scaling technologies as someone who wants to transact in a complex nature without giving away trading strategies, then these can be very helpful in terms of enabling that. But you also think about it from the perspective of being a validator for a network. And if you are an entity that wants to be regulated, you want to know that you are being compliant with the regulations, you can still utilize block relayers that can validate the transactions, even if you don't know what's in them, and know that you're only including transactions from addresses that have not been added to any type of sanctions deny list.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And so we're getting into some of the DeFi stuff. This is another big section of our paper, Jack. So let's turn there now. One of the things we talked about in the paper are stablecoins. And one question we ask kind of hypothetically, are algo stables the equivalent of alchemy in digital assets? So if you think of alchemy trying to spin straw into gold or create gold synthetically, are these algo stables equivalent, something that people are going to continue to try to do, but are fundamentally flawed and never going to happen? I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, so we saw the Luna ecosystem collapsed nearly overnight back in April or May of 2022. And I think we have some algo stable like coins like Frax, for instance, that uses a partial algo stable model that is mostly collateralized, but uses a portion of their own token that sort of makes it an algo stable. And they'll continue to exist. But it feels like it's sort of a forbidden word after what happened with Luna. And you'd be sort of hard pressed to see an ecosystem launch an algo, purely, algorithmic stablecoin that isn't collateralized or nearly fully collateralized anytime soon and gain major traction. And so I think for the time being, like DAI sort of continues to fulfill the role of a sort of decentralized digital dollar, or at least a more decentralized version of what a centralized fiat-backed USDC offers for the time being. And then you do have the continued expansion of these completely centralized fiat-backed stablecoins like USDC and Tether's USDT. And that gets into sort of another viewpoint that I have, which is the continued expansion of regulated stablecoins and more transparent stablecoins outpacing the expansion of less regulated stablecoins. And so one of the clear examples of this would be looking at USDC versus USDT over the past year or so. We've seen more volume growth of USDC usage on chain year over year in terms of growth, as well as on a relative market cap basis, USDC continues to sort of eat into the market share of Tether's USDT. And so I think that's sort of transparent and regulated winning against less transparent and less regulatory friendly stablecoins. And I feel like that's a trend that will continue into the future, as well as sort of enhanced scrutiny of collateral duration and credit quality for these centralized fiat-backed stablecoins. We've seen Circle start to be more and more transparent about what's actually backing their stablecoin.
And I think that's the key, right? You get down to what is the confidence in the collateral? Is it sufficiently collateralized? And if so, are the assets liquid? Oftentimes, I think about it like this. The absence of communication can lead to a crisis of confidence. And you see that when you think about the questions around, was Tether fully backed before? And then there were reports of being less than 100% backed. You see the shift. Different stablecoins are now, whether it's the USDC coin that you were just mentioning, Jack, where there's a little bit more disclosure around some of the holdings. But even DAI, we saw the proposal where DAI now has created stablecoin units that are backed by real world assets such as US Treasuries. So I think that confidence will increase and utilization will potentially increase as we have more transparency around what assets are backing it and what the liquidity of those assets is.
Yeah, absolutely. And on that note, Jason, I just saw an article this morning or last night, a Bloomberg article actually, where there's some admission, it looks like, that the Binance stablecoin was not always fully backed due to perhaps operational issues or something like that. So again, it gets back to that communication and your confidence in there. So turning to DeFi and trading now. So Jack, 2022 was interesting because we saw things like Uniswap volume being larger than the large centralized exchange volume. To me, I think this trend continues. I don't see kind of how it doesn't, especially in light of everything that's happened. I think people are just going to continue to gravitate towards that. But what's your take, or what are some of the things you think we could see in terms of decentralized exchanges and DeFi trading, as well as you have a section on yields as well?
Yeah, I feel like that's the ultimate vision of what sort of crypto, and in particular what DeFi is trying to create, is to make a more transparent, easily accessible version of an existing financial system that operates with rules instead of rulers, essentially. And what did we do over the past year? What did we find out? Well, a lot of things that happened was people just took crypto assets and then gave them to intermediaries and added trust back into the equation. I'm hopeful that maybe in 2023, we start to see some of these signs you mentioned, like Uniswap volumes, especially around some of the dates where we did see large systemic events for CeFi. We did see these volumes on DEXs increase dramatically because people were actually using the assets on chain. I'm hopeful that that sort of continues, especially as we talk about all the time, the actual ability to make those trades and interface with these platforms is getting better and better. A lot of people now are trading with aggregators. And if you use like 1inch or Paraswap, these different aggregators, or even now there's meta aggregators that aggregate the aggregators to give you best execution. And now you can start to see trading that like is price-wise on par with trading on centralized exchanges. And then some of these like derivatives platforms for traders, like the trade experience is getting better and better and more on par with CeFi. And I feel like that trend continues into the future. One of the big talking points going into this year, I think, that will continue is around the actual trading models. So a lot of these platforms use AMMs, automated market makers, and you're trading across liquidity pools. And so there's not really a variety of trade types. So like placing things like limit orders and stuff, trading like a traditional centralized limit order book, CLOBS is what people use to abbreviate it, isn't or hasn't really been fully possible at scale in DeFi. And I think that, you know, some platforms like what DYDX is doing, moving to an app chain where they can sort of custom design what they want on their own platform to try to create this centralized exchange feel on a decentralized exchange in a more transparent way, I think you're going to see DEXs compete into the future against, you know, centralized exchanges.
I have to just say one thing. The irony is like just so glaring. You have intermediaries as meta aggregators who are sitting there aggregating the aggregators. So like, you know, it is decentralized, but you're talking about there is a demand and a desire for efficiency and best execution. So this is, I think, net. It's a net maturation of this industry. But if in the end, if we have, as you were pointing out, decentralized exchanges that are competitive in offering similar capabilities to centralized exchanges, that's a positive for the industry.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that gets into, you know, maybe another topic. If we go from trading to yields, is historically, and I know Parth had talked about this on last week's episode, is DeFi yields and CeFi, you know, centralized finance, traditional yields on things like treasuries, we've seen this inverse correlation. And now you would have to ask the question, if someone's looking for yield, why would they not just go buy US treasuries? There's less risk embedded in buying treasuries than there is in holding stablecoins on a platform that's going to offer you a lower yield. And that is a very relevant question. But we're starting to see is like groups like Maker. Jason, we were talking about DAI a little bit. They have things like real-world assets, $100 million loan to Huntington Valley Bank, $500 million investment in U.S. treasuries and U.S. corporate bonds through Montalis. They agreed to, you know, a few different things with Gemini and Coinbase, with their respective stablecoins that would pass on a portion of the yield that those stablecoin issuers are receiving for, you know, holding the underlying collateral. And what's happening? We're seeing things like, for instance, the DAI savings rate, where you can take your DAI and put it into a smart contract and earn a yield. There was just a vote that I believe passed to raise that DAI savings rate materially. And so we're seeing like yields from the centralized system as real world assets start to interface with DAOs and these DeFi protocols. Like, I think that yields start to converge because, you know, you're basically bringing the traditional system in and passing those yields through into this DeFi system. And so one of the sort of projections forward that I'm thinking, and of course, we don't know, but I think that we're going to see a convergence of yields rather than this historically inverse correlation between DeFi and CeFi yields.
Yeah, you're really kind of talking about more efficient markets. And as you were saying that, I did a quick scan of the DeFi Llama site to just see what are the APIs on these different stablecoin pools. And some of them are basis points. Some of them are low single digit percentage points. There's a couple outliers that seem to be forecasting. One I see as double digit, but I think you're right in that the comparison is going to be based on what is the risk tolerance that I am willing to incur for a relative rate of return. And as that relative rate of return essentially normalizes and becomes more in line, whether it's traditional finance or DeFi, then it's going to be all about, I think, not just your confidence, but what's your intended use case? How long do you want to hold something? Where do you want to have it? So I think it's, a sign of maturation. I don't want to say it's good or bad because I think it depends on where you are in your view of the markets, but it does signal to me that DeFi markets are becoming more mature.
Yeah. Yeah. If I had to put an analogy, you know, think of traditional finance markets versus or developed markets versus these frontier markets, right? We've seen time and time again, there's this huge risk premium on those. They have much higher yields, potential capital appreciation, but as they mature, they converge, right? So it's kind of the same story, in my opinion, of these things maturing, that risk premium shrinking, and like you said, Jason, that a sign of maturation.
In terms of CeFi right now, like we've seen a change in the landscape around centralized finance lenders in the crypto space. Who knows? You know, there may be some type of resurgence again. There'll be use for these assets. There'll be more trust. But as we know, Jack, you talked about rules versus rulers. We saw that DeFi protocols operated as intended and as expected during some of these market downturns, or I'll call them credit events that were triggered by activities on these centralized lenders. So
particularly the longstanding, widely used, you know, what, to the degree that you can call something blue chip in DeFi, the sort of the blue chip or household names in DeFi, it certainly did what they were sort of promising to do for their users. And they didn't treat anyone differently. We saw, you know, even CeFi, some of these CeFi protocols had outstanding loans through some of these DeFi protocols, and they didn't treat them any differently. And that's exactly what you want this system to do. Treat every person and institution the exact same, because they're just a number in a spreadsheet. They're not a person that you can identify and then, you know, judge them or treat them a certain way. But that's the beauty of code, right? And so really, all together, if we look at, you know, sort of 2022, we saw many, you know, series of failures in crypto, but I don't think that that's anything new. Chris, you sort of rounded out the piece saying, you know, the class of 2022 graduates from the school of hard knocks. What do you mean by that? And maybe take us home here.
Yeah, maybe an old school phrase, but just anyone who emerged from this has obviously got a few battle scars, but hopefully some lessons learned that can only be learned through experience, the school of hard knocks, right? And kind of like what we've talked about before, you know, this is like an organism, or if you think of biology, anything that it can absorb or fight against and come out stronger. Anything that doesn't kill them makes them stronger. I think that's what this does to the industry, right? And so as hard as it's been, we're going to look back on this, at least I'm confident of this, and say, yeah, all of these things were terrible, but it's made us what we are today, 5-10 years down the road. And so for that, I'm thankful. And then I'm also just really, truly excited. I'm not just saying this, truly excited about all these things we just talked about now, showing that this industry is far from over. Everyone's still building. This technology is real. And that's why we're here. We're here for the long term. We're here to build and continue to do this in a sustainable way. And so I'm really excited for 2023.
Absolutely. I think that's a great way to round us out. Chris, thanks for joining. I'm sure we'll have you back again this year. And thanks everybody for listening.
Digital assets are speculative and highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and are only for those investors willing to risk losing some or all of their investment and who have the experience and ability to evaluate the risks and merits of an investment. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. This podcast was produced by Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, also known as FCAT. FCAT does not offer digital assets nor provide clearing or custody of such assets. It is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide tax, legal, insurance, or investment advice, and should not be construed as an offer to sell, a solicitation of an offer to buy, or a recommendation for any security or other asset by any Fidelity entity or any third party. Views expressed are as of the date indicated, based on the information available at the time, and may change based on market or other conditions. Unless otherwise noted, the opinions provided are those of the authors and not necessarily those of Fidelity Investments or its affiliates. Fidelity does not assume any duty to update any of the information. Fidelity and any other third parties mentioned in the podcast are independent entities and not affiliated. Mentioning them does not suggest a recommendation or endorsement by Fidelity. This information is not intended for distribution to or use by any person or entity in any jurisdiction or country where such distribution or use would be contrary to local law or regulation. Persons accessing this information are required to inform themselves about and observe such restrictions. Third-party trademarks appearing herein are the property of the respective owners. All others are the property of FMR LLC. Copyright 2023 FMR LLC. All rights reserved. 1040156.